Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, a new study from the Institute of National Sciences in France shows that eating organic food reduces our cancer risk. Well, hold on. We've been told by the skeptics on Wikipedia and the quackbusters that, organic and regular food, including GMO food, it's all the same. No, it's not. And we'll get into that in some depth with a lot more studies, how to live a longer and healthier life. Then we're going to offer a challenge to Newsweek and their support of a major article attacking any parent or any person, scientist, doctor, journalist, who questions the safety and efficacy of vaccines. And we'll be doing that ourselves with Richard Gale here in studio. Then we're going to play a clip, part of it, and it's really well done, by a parent who also has a child with autism who was completely normal until the vaccines, and this person is talking about the dangers of the nanny state. And also, what's it like to work for Donald Trump? Well, one of the people that work for Trump will be talking about what he's like to work with. And I don't think this will be a big surprise to a lot of people, but it's one thing to hear from someone who's been with him for a long time, because it gives some interesting insights into this man's personality. Because from that personality is what we see today. So we have a lot to share, and I'll be also taking some of your questions that I look forward to. And depending upon how many I take and how long it takes to answer them is what we'll do with the remainder of that time. But we have a pretty packed show. To investigate the association between organic food consumption and cancer risk, in a large prospective study, they used 68,946 French adults who reported their frequency of organic food consumption, and then they wrote down everything they were eating, fruits, vegetables, soy-based products, anything that was organic. And then they were followed for a period of time. And then they had to keep a diary of all this and how they felt. And the data was adjusted for confounding factors like lifestyle and dietary patterns, baseline age, sex, occupation, educational level, marital status, monthly income, household, number of children, smoking status. All that was collected too, because that could also determine your health outcomes. And 78% of the participants were female, and the average age was 44 years of age. What they found was, when all this was looked at, that there was a substantial difference in the health outcome of people, especially with cancer, of people followed a healthy organic diet. Big difference. Big difference. There was 34% less breast cancer. In men, there was 13% less prostate cancer. There was also less colorectal cancer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and other lymphomas. So the high organic food scores were inversely associated with the overall risk of cancer, meaning the more you ate organic food, the less cancer you had. So that's an important study. One more, it's not the only one. There are many other studies showing the advantages of eating organic. From the University of Exeter and Oxford universities, both in Great Britain, being kind to yourself has mental and physical benefits. Just simple things, taking time to think kind thoughts about yourself and others, has psychological and physical benefits. And it can calms the heart rate. It switches off the body's threat response that keeps your cortisol levels high. It brings your cortisol levels down. And previous studies have shown that this threat response damages the immune system. Because when you feel stressed, your cortisol levels go up. That is bad. And this was published in the Clinical Psychological Society Journal. So We have too many opportunities to feel bad about ourselves. And if we don't have enough, there are a lot of other people in our society today with politically correct attitudes and identity politics who want us to feel if we're not in completely alignment with them and their views and their beliefs and their grouping, that we should be feeling bad about ourselves. And nothing could be further from the truth. It's just the opposite. Self-love, appreciation, and then love for others and appreciation. And if you have a choice of criticizing someone or complimenting someone, consider the outcome. Someone may not let you know that they feel bad being spoken about negatively, but they do. And I know people who make it, the whole dominant theme in their personality is to dominate other people. And they do this by depreciating the value of another person until one day a person no longer feels value because they've been put down so many times. So just consider that, the power of positive thoughts. From Queen Mary University in London, vitamin D helps treat lethal drug-resistant tuberculosis. That's right, vitamin D has been found to speed up the clearance of tuberculosis bacteria from the lungs of people with multiple drug-resistant TB. And that's important. So vitamin D on a daily basis is really good for you, but if you have TB, it's especially important for you. From UCLA Longevity Center, this was a randomized, double-blind, two-group, placebo-controlled study. It was about curcumin. Cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N. So to assess whether curcumin had measurable effects on cognitive performance in older adults, and especially those with dementia, they used curcumin, and it worked. One more study, there are thousands of studies on curcumin. They didn't even use a lot. They used 90 milligrams of curcumin twice a day, or 180 milligrams of curcumin for 18 months. I would have started at 5,000 milligrams. They are so behind the scientific curve. But still, I commend them because even with such a small amount, they saw substantial improvement in cognitive performance, in verbal performance on the Bushkell Selective Reminding Test, on in visual performance on the Brief Visual Memory Test, on the attention with the Trial Making A Secondary Outcome Measurement Test. So all these brain tests, if you took curcumin at 180 milligrams, you improved. Wow. I wouldn't even think of suggesting curcumin for someone under, let's say, 500 milligrams. That's just tiny amount, in my opinion. But still, even small amounts made a difference. From the University of Alabama at Birmingham, they did a study on NSAIDs. Those are your non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. These are painkillers. Now, they can relieve pain and inflammation. However, prolonged use raises the risk of heart and kidney failure. A heart attack causes death of heart muscle cells by lack of oxygen. It also significantly injures the kidneys. And they found that all this non-steroidal and anti-inflammatory is really playing havoc with us. So I'm glad they did the study, finally, and this was published in Life Sciences. But at least now we know that thousands, tens of thousands of people each year are dying in America from taking these non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like ibuprofen and aspirin. But if you want to turn off pain, why not use cat's claw, cayenne, burdock root, vitamin C? All of those also help turn off pain. Well, that wasn't a study, but there, at least it shows you how bad the orthodox approach is. It was 40 years ago that I did a debate on television in New York on ABC about ginseng. The person I was debating said there was no value to it, no science. And they were right as far as the science in America, but had they gone down to my home state, West Virginia, or gone up to other states like Wisconsin, they would have found that while ginseng was known to help people for hundreds of years. However, they were looking in the wrong place. I looked at the Japanese Academy of Science, the Chinese Academy of Science, and I found 5,000 different studies on the benefits of ginseng. Now we do have some research in the United States on ginseng, but still the majority is done in South Korea, China, or Japan. Here's the latest, and this is from the Kung Hee University in South Korea, and it talks about mountain ginseng, which is actually Pan-X ginseng. And they said that mountain ginseng found to have immunostimulating antioxidant, anti-cancer, and anti-aging properties. That's terrific. And it is as good as the pharmaceuticals and what it's supposed to do, and it's an adaptogenic one. So it does all these wonderful things in our body. So you might want to consider having in your tea some ginseng. And just put a, you can get the red ginseng, you can get the Panax ginseng. It's all good. I mentioned a few weeks ago how dangerous any kind of drug drinking is, and especially when you're younger. So you go out and you go drinking one night. Maybe one of your buddies does some binge drinking. And the next morning everything seems fine. It is not. You've created massive inflammation in your brain, your kidneys, your heart, and your liver. The body will do all it can to help recover, but there's damage done. This is the University of Illinois. Heavy drinking as a teenager causes lasting changes in your emotional center of the brain, and especially binge drinking, and that's very common now in men and women in college campuses. So when you're an adolescent, you're stupid, and most are, and you're doing really stupid things, which most do, it's been shown to have lasting effects on the wiring of the brain, and it's associated with an increased risk of psychological problems and alcohol use later in life. Now researchers at the University of Illinois at Chicago, Center for Alcohol Research and Epigenetics, have shown that some of these lasting changes are the result of epigenetic changes that alter the expression of a protein crucial for the formation and maintenance of neural connections in the amygdala. That's the part of the brain involved in emotion and fear and anxiety. And their results, which are based on the analysis of postmodern human brain tissue, was published in Translational Psychiatry. So it just means that you drink as a teenager, later in life, you have some real serious emotional problems, especially when it comes to fear, when it comes to being able to deal with anxiety, when it comes to your emotions, they're not normal at that point. Now think of the problem, because maybe you haven't drank in years. So when you're talking with your physician or even psychologist, they're not going to say, well, as a teenager, did you drink? Well, teenager, man, that's a long time ago. And they're going to think, well, if it didn't happen yesterday or last month or last year, it's not relevant. It is. That's the epigenetics of it. And also, for those of you having OCD, which is obsessive compulsive disorder, it can be challenged in a way that most people never imagine. An architect had OCD and cured himself with magnet therapy. That's right, magnets. And the person used magnets. Now, I remember there was a psychiatrist who I had on the air 30 years ago, longer. He put together some magnets, about 10,000 gals, four of them together, and he made like a little pillow, and he embedded them in a sleeve in the pillow. So when people slept who had depression or anxiety or problems falling asleep at night, when they used this pillow, they fell asleep. It wasn't the pillow, it was the magnets in the pillow. And then in our office at the Tri-State Healing Center, we would have people come in the evening. In fact, they were there all day, but every time I would go in this one room, we made this one room look like a tropical rainforest. We put a CD in there, or it wasn't a CD at that time, it was a tape of rainfall, thunderstorms, rain hitting a tin roof. And then we had a water wall in there where water came down, and the whole room had been painted. And people never knew this. It was actually a very famous painter did it as a favor to me when I'd helped his sister overcome her cancer. And we had 12 chairs, and the walls were made out of bamboo, where we put bamboo on top of the walls, and the tropical mural that he did was just phenomenal. The ceiling, you could look up and see birds in flight like macaw that you would see in the rainforest. You felt like you were in a tropical jungle. The sounds, the feeling. But we also did something. We put magnets in the headrest, and people would come in with anxiety and depression, and they'd lay there on that reclining chair for an hour, and they'd see enormous improvement. I never published anything on it, and I didn't do a study. I should have. I didn't. One of the studies I wished I had, but now by getting this man's report of how he overcame his obsessive-compulsive disorder using magnets, so it shouldn't be a surprise. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be joined in studio by Richard Gale, and we're going to offer a legitimate challenge to Newsweek and ask them that if we were able to find this information, why can't they, with all their reporters and all their resources, and why are they allowing the promotion of absolute McCarthyite dogma that if you challenge the safety and efficacy of vaccines, you're somehow a danger to the world. You're as dangerous as, you know, a plague, which is just nonsense. Boy, the corporatized thought process. Everything to protect the interests of Big Pharma. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We have now with us on the line Richard Gale. Hi, Richard.
Oh, good afternoon, Gary.
Richard, take us through this segment of why we are so concerned about the complete attack against any mother or father. They've already been damaged. Their lives changed because they had a loving, growing, evolving child, took the vaccines, and then their child evolved into some form of autism spectrum disorder or brain damage or some other limitation. And now they're told that if you criticize vaccines, there's something wrong with you. You're the danger to the public. And even Australia has made it against the law to criticize vaccines. And they've even banned parents from going, and doctors. Dr. Sherry Penny was banned from Australia for even wanting to educate the public about vaccines.
Well, what we're experiencing right now is consolidation of the drug industry, pharmaceutical industry, and vaccine makers with public policy. The most telling story, I think, was one that appeared in USA Today last week with the title that today's skepticism of vaccines could be as big of a health threat as HIV. Just equating these two, HIV and vaccine, rejecting vaccines, is an indication of just how far they're willing to go. It's very dangerous rhetoric. It's a kind of an irrational hyperbole one might even expect to come from Trump's mouth. The article itself is a diatribe with no substance. But what I did was I looked into the author of this article, and this author, he's a scholar, I don't believe he's a professor, from the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Now this is and I did some undercover work into who this group is. It's part of Johns Hopkins, a very prestigious university's public health program. But it's a department set aside with partnerships with the CDC on health security. They released a press release, it was last November, where the CDC and the partner and its partners with the Johns Hopkins Center are building a foundation to begin implementing globally a vaccine program. And it should be noted that basically the CDC is primarily an intelligence gathering and analyst agency. They're very connected with the Department of Defense. They have adopted so many of the Department of Defense's Homeland Security's and National Security agencies, different methods and strategies for implementing and trying to get citizens vaccinated and off. There was another press release that was in 2017 where another partnership between this security agency and, or security department at Johns Hopkins and the CDC, which was specifically on intelligence gathering and operations to strengthen vaccine compliance. And it was all done under the moniker of building resilience to high consequence infectious disease events, including smallpox, flu, hepatitis. So, this is a very dangerous area that we're working in, that we're entering, and what we are seeing right now across the country, and including in New York State now, there is in almost every state these efforts being made to mandate the entire vaccine regimen. This article in the USA Today is stating that, well, it's repeating what the World Health Organization recently, in a report that they released, that vaccine refusal is among the top 10 health threats in the world. So it's not even that they're looking at the diseases themselves. It's just people who do not agree with the vaccine paradigm and its safety and efficacy. Those are now the risk. And the example that's most being used, of course, is the MMR, which is being in the USA Today report. But the truth is the MMR vaccination has not decreased at all. And what the agencies are doing is take no vaccines, you're considered a vaccine denier. Or if you take 23 of the 24 main scheduled vaccine, primary scheduled vaccines, you are also included as a denier. So even if people haven't reached a full compliance, you are still considered in the exempt group. And that's the way they kind of catapult these fictitious numbers to suggest that there is this growing vaccine denialism, which is growing, but not near to the degree that what we're being told. And we might remember that there was a study. It was a groundbreaking study about 3 years ago, published in the Clinical Infectious Diseases Journal, and it was done by the Bureau of Immunization in New York City, along with the CDC, where it was the first study that found that individuals with a prior evidence of measles vaccination and with vaccine immunity were both capable of being infected with the measles and were infecting others. That was the importance of the story, that even though people are being vaccinated, there is still vaccine drift, and that you can infect others. So this big outbreak that we're being told about in Washington State, a measles outbreak, and now they're reporting it could spread across the country. This could just very easily be done through the vaccinated population, because there are people within that have been affected in Washington State who are also have come down with measles. It's kind of like they're trying to compare that each new vaccine as well is worth as celebrating the new iPhone upgrade. There's with all the applause for all the new vaccines that are coming into the pipeline. So So that's kind of where we're at. That's where the U.S., USA today, what I think is most dangerous for us is that that the CDC is directly involved in the media and are very likely the ones that are providing the templates upon which and the advice on how the mainstream media is reporting all these events.
Put into proper context for this audience, when a person gets a vaccine, like the flu vaccine, they're shedding that vaccine out of their nose and for several weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, which means that children who get the flu vaccine go to school, they're coughing, they're wiping their nose, their desks are contaminated, the air is contaminated, they go home, the doorknobs, refrigerator, the telephone, silverware, all contaminated. So other members are picking up that virus and now being themselves infected. The CDC is a complete criminal organization. It is utterly corrupt from top to bottom, much like the FDA. And let me tell you how corrupt it is. This is the same organization that for 40 years was so vile and so institutionally racist at every level that allowed hundreds of African Americans to live with syphilis and spread it amongst the African American community. And syphilis is very easy to spread without ever treating them where they could have cured the disease. They were being used as human guinea pigs. Now they have, in 2001, there was a study that showed that there was a high incidence and demonstrable incidence of African-American boys 36 months and under who had over 224% increase in autism spectrum disorder from the MMR vaccine. Instead of warning, take this vaccine out of the schedule, instead, they doubled down and covered it up. The person who was responsible were all the people clear up to the director of the CDC. The person who was the head of that particular study was a person named Dr. William Thompson. Now, at the very same time in England, in Great Britain, there was a group of scientists, 12 in all, who had done a study by evaluating gastrointestinal disturbances in a group of children diagnosed with autism. They didn't do the diagnosis. And they wanted to see whether or not there was an association between their autism conditions, mitochondrial dysfunction, and the MMR vaccine. All of the doctors were pro-vaccine, including Dr. Andrew Wakefield. The last time I spoke to him, he was still pro-vaccine. They said that they believed there might be an association, but there was more research that was needed. Well, they published the article in The Lancet, then that article was retracted, and then they were attacked personally. The two people who were really singled out for attack was the premier gastroenterologist in the world, he and Andrew Wakefield. And he fought them and got, not only did he get his medical license reinstated and all charges against him dropped, but the judge excoriated the medical council for doing this to him. Now, that meant that the same identical charges leveled at him were also leveled at Andrew Wakefield. They're one and the same. Therefore, that meant that Andrew Wakefield's charges were also bogus. The attacks against him were bogus. They were set up. And behind all this was the pharmaceutical industry. The difference is Andrew Wakefield was no longer in England. He was in the United States. He had run out of money and didn't have the money to go back and officially get his reputation cleared. I believe he should have. And it's one of the disagreements he and I have at this time, because he certainly raised a lot of money, but what he spent it on is his business. Now, that could have been completely avoided had the CDC and Thompson at the same time said, hold on a second, Great Britain, hold on before you excoriate and crucify two innocent people. We can prove that what they found is correct, because we can show this happening here. But they didn't. The Vera Stratton study showed this. They hid that. The CDC found that. They hid that. And it was only later when Dr. Brian, what was his last name?
Brian Hooker.
Brian Hooker, a scientist who I just had on, his son had developed autism. And he was asking for Freedom Information Act documents. Normally, there's no communication. You just receive them or you don't, or you get an excuse. But Thompson decided to call him, and they started up this phone friendship. They had over 40 phone calls. And near the end of this, Brian began to see that he was doing a mea culpa, meaning Dr. Thompson was telling him that he had committed crimes, that they had all committed crimes at the CDC. So he began to record these. And he got Thompson to send him documents, thousands of documents. Then he gave those documents to Representative Posey from Florida. Then it all went public. And then everything changed. We haven't heard from Dr. Thompson since. The CDC closed ranks. Remember, the CDC is a military organization. It's not a civilian organization. You have officers, you have ranks, and you can't break rank. And Thompson tried to go to the head of the CDC, Judy Gerberding, at the time, but she didn't want anything to do with this. And she immediately left the CDC and went to work for Merck. And from what I saw from her stock, she made over $3 million. How much more, I don't know. But it was a revolving door. So the CDC is absolutely complicit in covering up information that African-American boys are getting autism from the MMR vaccine. So we have found this. We've done over 15,000 hours of research. In fact, if you go to prn.fm, prn.fm, you will see on our front page 51 articles, more than anyone else I'm aware of in America, have written, fully documented. You could present them in a court of law, showing the corruption of vaccines, the lack of science, lack of efficacy in any and all of the vaccines. And we go after the hard scientists because we are both in the scientific community. And we've published in peer-reviewed literature, and I was the head for 33 years of the Institute of Applied Biology's Anti-Aging Science Division. So we can read the literature, we cite the literature, and we show where everything we've been told about vaccines are lies. So if we can find this out, just the two of us, and publish 52 articles and do 4 award-winning films, why can't the editors, the publishers of the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, MSNBC, or USA Today find the same information? Because it's there. And why haven't they allowed William Thompson to testify under oath before Congress? Because the CDC is controlled by the pharmaceutical industry, and your politicians are controlled by the pharmaceutical industry. So when you look at this, you see, my God, how corrupt is this entire system? What have I left out, or what have I gotten wrong there, Richard?
I haven't gotten anything wrong. But on the good news is things in other parts of the world are changing. Italy now is really challenging. Japan has been challenging the vaccine paradigm. If there is maybe an upside to globalization, aside from all the many downsides of economic globalization, medical science is more available, and surprisingly, the best research is showing the real dangerous vaccines are coming out of Israel. Israel shows far more care for the health of its public than many of the other developed nations, and it's not compromised by the pharmaceutical industry at all. So there's some excellent, all the aluminum studies on aluminum adjuvants. The best ones are all coming out of Israel, the university, I can't remember the professor's name at Hebrew University. So that's kind of a good side, that the science is getting out there. The science is available. Unfortunately, in our country, our mainstream media has been completely compromised by the CDC and by the dominant medical paradigm that our federal health agencies espouse. But they've done this if you're a medical journalist for CNN or New York Times or any of these, and we reported one of our articles is on this, you get a lot of benefits and perks by attending the CDC's kind of indoctrination programs in medical journalism. You're given, the CDC provides you templates for which you can write your articles on. You don't have to do much searching and personal investigative work to find the stories you want to report on, because the CDC provides that for you. And So so for a journalist, it makes your life much, much easier. And so it's almost like there's no incentive for these people to get paid well by, if you're with any of these mainstream media outlets, to really do any kind of, that's why journalism is such a dismal state today, whether it's medical journalism or political journalism. And, but fortunately in some other countries, it's not quite that way. And there are politicians in other countries that are challenging and questioning vaccines. And I hopefully that will continue, but as long as they can continue to provide the science for us, science is available. It's available for anybody to see.
Thank you, Richard. And we're going to we're going to specifically go to a clip where the person you're hearing has a vaccine in your child. And there are millions, I repeat, millions of women in America who have vaccine-injured children, and they really do their homework. They spend thousands of hours, many, collecting the data to help them better understand how this happened. Why aren't they believed? Why are they attacked? Why do other women allow them to be attacked? This is wrong. We're going to defend those women. Here's one segment.
Today we're going to talk about vaccines.
So I don't know if you guys saw, but apparently the World Health Organization in 2019 has declared that among the top threats to global health are anti-vaxxers.
Movement in the United States being labeled a global health threat.
It's the anti-vaxxer movement.
Now the World Health Organization has labeled anti-vaxxers as one of their top 10 global health threats for 2019.
It's not hype.
So if for whatever reason you don't want to vaccinate yourself or your children, you are now officially considered a top threat to global health by WHO?
In addition to anti-vaxxers, the World Health Organization also named air pollution, climate change, non-communicable diseases, and HIV to their list of global health threats.
And you have states all over the place trying to pass legislation to remove a parent's right to exempt their child from vaccines.
And I'm for parental rights, not government coercion, telling us what we can do, what we can't do with our kids. There is no other mandated procedure. First of all, it's illegal. You can't make people do procedures that they don't want.
Oregon is one such state. In 2015, they tried to do this, and there was a huge public outcry. People were super angry about it. And it did not pass because people wouldn't stand for it. But now, seemingly as an in run around that, what you have is Oregon is now set to become the first state in the nation to require universal home visits for all parents who have babies or adopt children in Oregon. Bill 526 has been introduced. And you'll notice Senator Hayward's name is number one up on that list. We'll get to her in just a minute. But they are passing a thing right now to study the feasibility of these home visits and submit the findings to get this going as soon as possible. They're saying they have to do this because an emergency is declared to exist. Look down here at section 3. It says, this 2019 act being necessary for the immediate preservation of the public peace, health, and safety, an emergency is declared to exist, and this act takes effect on its passage. So they're trying to get this through as quickly as they possibly can.
So there you go. There's no law that you have to take vaccines or that you have to let a government worker into your house. And again, with no warrant or anything. And they want to give you the idea that so-called public health trumps your personal rights. And you can see right here, they're trying to use the perception that this is some prevailing emergency to just trample on people's rights, disrespect their privacy, and get into your home in attempt to get into your head and tell you what to do.
And this guy's Patrick Allen. He runs the Oregon Health Authority, and they interviewed him about it at the Beaverton Valley Times. And he says that he's most excited about the beginning investment in a six-year program to create universal home visits for new parents. When the program's complete, every new parent, and that includes adoptions, will receive a series of two or three visits by someone like a nurse or healthcare practitioner. And then they get real vague about what may or may not happen at those visits, but the visits could include basic health screenings for babies, hooking parents up with primary care physicians, linking them to other services, and coordinating the myriad childhood immunizations that babies need, which is the most specific thing on the list.
These are people who, if they're registered nurses, if they're regular nurses, have had a few years of medical training, but it doesn't make them more qualified to raise your child than you, who love them. So basically, you've got door-to-door salesmen for the big pharma companies and the vaccine companies trying to sell their poisons and push them on people who've been holding out against taking them. And you can virtually guarantee that they'll be doing the home visits to those people who don't have their vaccine records up to date. So they'll be hitting those houses first. But I'm pretty sure you don't have to let them in. It doesn't seem very constitutional to me. You don't even have to answer the census question other than telling them how many people live in your house.
As I said, everything surrounding this is incredibly vague. And as Paula Boyard points out over at PJ Media, it's not absolutely clear whether these are going to be mandatory or not. But the use of the term universal suggests that it would be. And they're at least going to send them to your house, and you're going to have interaction one way or the other, whether you turn them away or not.
Well, aren't you going to ask me to come in?
And they're not talking about what's going to happen if you refuse such a visit under a mandated universal program. But she also goes on to point out proponents for this are arguing that without this kind of state-mandated surveillance, children are at higher risk for abuse and neglect, which for some reason they believe that agents of the government can protect these children from, despite the fact that in Oregon, children in the foster care system are abused at twice the national rate. So, as this writer points out, how are they exactly going to quote-unquote take care of another 40,000 children every year when they can't even take care of the ones that are already in their foster care system, considering they're abused at twice the national rate in this country, in the state of Oregon? It's outrageous. This isn't something for people in trouble. This is stuff all kids need, Allen says. And then about a week later, they put out another article. They describe it a little bit more down here. It's actually going to be three visits. It says at 2 weeks, the baby's weight gain will be checked. The baby could get a heel stick, the pinprick drawing of blood that checks for metabolic indicators of problems, which at that point show no outward symptoms. At 2 months, the nurses and families could discuss the many vaccines that babies face. So at 2 months is when you, as a parent, will now be pressured into vaccinating your child with someone coming into your home to tell you that you should do it.
We have 20 or 30, maybe 40 rounds of vaccines, and we're using this state emergency law to try to high-pressure sell you. What do you think? We could do it right here.
It also says they're going to not just check on the baby, but they're also going to be checking up on the parents. So they're saying, because, you know, having a baby is stressful, so they're going to be looking for signs of postpartum depression, and they're going to be making sure there's a safe place for the baby to sleep and to be bathed, and more. They're going to be looking for more. They didn't say what the more is, but that's what they're going to be doing. Sounds like a pretty open, free reign of who knows what they're going to be doing. You know what it sounds like? It sounds like preemptively sending a CPS worker into every person's house who has a baby in Oregon, who's also going to pressure them into having vaccinations. That's actually just, if you sum it all up, that's a lot of what it sounds like to me when I read this.
Absolutely.
And I wonder what they're going to say if you are somebody who doesn't want to get vaccines. It's almost as if because they couldn't pass the 2015 legislation in Oregon, they're going to go around that and do this instead, where they actually send a person to your house from the state who's going to pressure you into it. I mean, just by virtue of having someone from the state come in to check up on you as a new parent, you're telling me that's not going to feel like pressure?
You know, if you don't do it, the state may not look so kindly on your parenting claim. Your kid might not be allowed into school. Could have CPS here. We could investigate you.
And what makes me even angrier about, I mean, this to me is outrageous. This is outrageous overstepping. This is a literal nanny state.
That's what I was saying. It's a literal nanny state. Welcome to the literal nanny state. That's the point we're at in this country. I can't believe this is happening.
Well, what's even more outrageous about it is the budget behind this legislation was proposed by the Ways and Means Committee. One of the people running that committee is Senator Elizabeth Steiner Hayward, who has come out to say that universal home visits are a priority for her. She also just so happens to be the sponsoring senator of the 2015 legislation to get rid of a parent's right to exempt their child from vaccines. See how that works? Because she's a medical doctor and she says that's what's in the best interest. However, it was pointed out during a hearing in 2015 when this was going down by a local attorney that Senator Hayward was featured in an article in the American Academy of Family Physicians where she was complaining about the fact that she has multiple sclerosis and her neurologist told her that because of the treatment she was on, she shouldn't breastfeed. So she went and got another doctor who agreed with her so she could breastfeed because she did research. And after she did her research, she said she did not think that she agreed with the neurologist. And as a parent, she was going to make her own decision about what she should do.
In an article that was published in the American Academy of Family Physicians, the sponsor of this bill is quoted as disregarding her treating doctor's advice because, in the paraphrase, I did the research and disagreed with her recommendation. She chose to breastfeed her child despite the medication that she was taking for her condition and despite the risk to her child from that medication.
My integrity has just been impugned by the witness. And I want to be really clear here, sir.
I'm not
No, sir. Please allow me to respond.
Sure.
I called the national expert on drugs and lactation from the University of Texas and asked him personally to clarify that interferons did not transfer from breast milk from the mother's tissue into breast milk before I made that decision for my child. And I also was well aware that breastfeeding is the best thing you can do to protect children from autoimmune diseases. So I would be very grateful if you did not take my decision, my personal decision about my medical care, out of context. Thank you.
Remember,
mine was science-based.
Remember,
mine was science-based.
We do not... I will have to ask people to leave if we don't have decorum. We do not impugn others. All right?
My statement was not intended in any manner of impugning or maligning the sponsor of this bill, only pointing out that her right to exercise her informed consent and make a different decision than her treating doctor is the same right that we as citizens are seeking for ourselves.
And when this attorney points out the obvious, come on, obvious hypocrisy of this, right? She got really angry because she knew. She was like, you're trying to impugn me. No, he's trying to point out what a hypocrite you are obviously being because it's obvious. Obvious hypocrite is obvious. That's not impugning her integrity. If she had integrity in the issue, that'd be one thing. It's so hypocritical what she's trying to do. Because she said she felt she knew what was best for her child. So she knows what's best for her child, but every other parent doesn't. And that is why they're going to send people preemptively into their houses. I mean, can you imagine? I don't know how many of you out there are parents, but I remember what it was like just in the state of Missouri where I had my children. You have to go down to the county health office to get your exemption. And in order to get it, you have to go through basically interrogation by a nurse who talks to you like you're stupid and ignorant and horrible and a bad parent. And how could you ever not vaccinate your children? Because vaccinations are just the most wonderful, amazing thing you could possibly do for your brand new baby. And if you won't do it, you're just awful. And they talk to you like that, you know? I went down there armed with research because I was not about to be intimidated out of my decision. If you guys have watched this channel for a long time, you know I have a vaccine-damaged child. We did 3 hours on vaccines back in the day.
You know our position on vaccinations. We already did a 2+ hour presentation on all the lies we were told about that, how people are not given informed consent when they take their children in to these well child visits to be shot up.
It's the greater good.
Oh my God. restrict parents' rights over vaccinations, states, and even a federal bill now saying they want to eliminate the philosophical exemption for vaccines, at least for kids going into Head Start, the poor kids who have to get federal assistance.
We're talking about why they're putting mercury in vaccines.
That's just part of the full interview. Can be heard on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com's website. Now let's go to your questions. I'll take as many as I can to the remainder of the program, and let's hear what we have.
Hi, my name is Francesca, and I just had a question. My daughter goes to preschool in New Jersey, and it's an Abbott preschool, and they provide lunch, and they don't allow any outside lunch. And they are serving beef 3 to 4 times a week, and I don't eat beef myself, and I don't give my children beef, and I asked the school not to give her beef, and they said they're able to substitute and not give her the beef only if she's allergic and she has a doctor's note. And I was just wondering if there's anything that I can do about this.
Okay, there's a lot you can do, and good for you for raising that question. First, educate yourself about what's wrong with meat in any form, animal proteins. There's too much meat in a child's body. These are young children. Their bodies are not but one-fifth or even less than what they will be as adults, yet they're fed almost adult portions. They're getting far too much protein, which creates ammonium and urea as byproducts. That can be toxic to the kidneys and liver. Separately, go to the scientific literature. Look at all the studies on meat and the dangers meat provide for a body. Then go to the scientific literature and find all of the plant-based proteins that are available and how not only do they not cause a problem, they actually turn off inflammation. And inflammatory conditions, especially in children, are one of the big problems with dairy and other products. Dairy is very common an allergen. So if you say that you want a dairy-free, meat-free diet, but here's the scientific literature supporting it, and here's the scientific literature supporting why a plant-based alternative like quinoa or brown rice or teft or spelt or millet is far healthier in fiber, B complex, phytonutrients, oat, beta-glucan, etc. So all of the scientific literature, 100% of the scientific literature is on your side. It just takes knowing how to review it. And only use the Library of Medicine because that's the government's official website for scientific research. So get the science on what's wrong with meat. Get the science on what's right with proteins from plant-based. And then present that and send it to every member of the school board. And have a registered dietitian sign off on it. And if you do that, then you have a chance of not only helping your child, but helping all children in the school and getting them to consider the consequences of hurting the children, and then start a campaign. If they say no to that, then get all the literature and distribute it to all the other parents of those children, and then stand outside the school and hound out literature showing this school is damaging our children's health because of economics and stupidity. They don't care about our children, only profits. Then embarrass them to a level where they have to do something. If you get it into court, invite me as an expert witness. Okay, we'll take another call.
My question is, given all these large populations of homeless people that have been, I'm going to say showing up lately, but I now think that they've been there for a while, in the subway system, it seems that they oftentimes have very swollen legs, and when they lift up the pants, they have these awful sores on them. And it seems to be happening amongst a large population of these homeless. It's not just like they're sitting there and their legs are fine. What is this inflammation from? What are these sores from? And why is it hitting a homeless population? Thank you, and thank you for your radio show and for the service.
There's several answers. First, many of the people are in subways because it's warmer. Separately, because you're less likely to be attacked than if you were up on a street and it's late at night. Thirdly, their legs are frequently swollen because they have diabetes. And homeless people don't have an opportunity to eat healthy meals. So if someone gives them money and not enough money to buy a meal, they'll frequently buy something that they can afford, like sugared candies or carbohydrated sweets or slice of pizza or a can of cola. All of this contributes to diabetes. It all contributes to poor vascular circulation. They're also not exercising. They frequently spend a lot of their time sitting. So that pulls the venous blood supply and can cause swelling. They frequently are in inflammation all the time. That will also cause swelling. If there's poor circulation and they're malnourished, they frequently end up with skin lesions or skin ulcers or diabetic ulcers that can cause amputation. That is also common. Some of these people have mental conditions and are not able to take care of themselves, and they were just dumped out of mental institutions onto the streets. That's cruel and inhumane. We should have places where people can go and have quality of life, quality meals, quality of care, irrespective of their capacity to pay. But we're not evolved enough as a society to appreciate those who cannot help themselves. Those are some of the reasons why we're saying this. We're out of time. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.